With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Brian German.
Good morning and thanks for joining us today. I'm your host, Brian German with AgNet West, and you're listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now, we've got this week's almond update a little later on in the show, and we will hear about a recent needs assessment for California grape growers. But first, in today's top story, the Department of Labor is hosting a public webinar highlighting the latest updates to the H-2A program. The webinar is scheduled for May 23rd and will feature personnel from the Office of Foreign Labor Certification, Office of Workforce Investment, and the Wage and Hour Division. There's not a registration requirement, however, attendance will be limited to 1,000 participants. A recording of the presentation will also be made available at a later date. The new final rule is set to go into effect on June 28th and has received criticism from several organizations, including the National Council of Agricultural Employers and the American Farm Bureau Federation. The webinar will cover key aspects of the new rule, including the immediate effective date of the adverse effect wage rates, clarifying termination for cause, improving program integrity and enforcement capabilities, and other topics. More information about the webinar is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. And in other news, I recently had the opportunity to talk to Melissa Cragen, Fresno County Agricultural Commissioner. And in Fresno County, there has been a declaration made in an attempt to mitigate some potential damage from beet leafhopper. And so let's just kind of start with what this declaration means and what's being attempted to address here.
Yeah, so the beet leafhopper is a pest in Fresno County and in most of the San Joaquin Valley that is a vector for the beet curly top virus. And this is a virus that affects a wide variety of host plants. However, tomatoes are particularly susceptible to the virus. And so when tomato plants have become infected with the virus, they become severely stunted and it causes the fruit to prematurely ripen. And so it can cause, really, really large reductions in yields. In normal years, those reductions in yields can be 20 to 30%. And then in years where you have heavy populations of beet leafhopper, you can see reductions in yields of 70 to 90%.
And so with this declaration, why was this needed and what types of materials are being impacted with this?
Yeah, so this declaration, it's new this year. And even though this is not a new pest, beet leafhopper has been present in the in California since early 1900s, however, in the last year there has been some regulations that have placed heavy restrictions on the use of neonicotinoid pesticides in California, and unfortunately, those happen to be the only materials that are effective against controlling beet leafhopper. And so one of the, part of the provisions of the regulatory package that went into effect early this year was that there's an exemption for use of neonicotinoids that are being used to control something under a local emergency proclamation. And so, that's really what is being done here is that, this pest is specific to the western portion of the San Joaquin Valley where it overwinters and then kind of comes down into the cropland. And so our board has, made the steps to proclaim a local emergency so that our farmers can use these materials to protect their crops, specifically tomatoes in Fresno County.
And looking at specifically tomatoes and the applications in that crop, you noted taking kind of a detailed approach as to where this will be allowed, not necessarily countywide, but you're looking at where this pest might potentially be the most problematic, right?
Correct. So we're looking, sort of on the definitely on the west side of Fresno County. And, this pest can, depending upon, winds and other factors, the pest can really move somewhat large across large portions. However, there is sort of a general migration. And so we're really looking at this point to limit it onto, the west side of Fresno County. Of course, should we see you know, further migration and need to expand that area, we certainly can do that. However, at this point, we're trying to keep it, you know, in the most reasonable geographic area that we can, because, you know, we want to make sure that we maintain the spirit of these regulations, but yet still, you know, make sure that we're giving farmers tools that they need to deal with, you know, these critical needs that there really aren't any alternatives for.
And in terms of, there's not really an effective way to project what kind of year it might be for the pest, but is there any kind of timeline or limitations as to when these applications can be made?
Well, the proclamation is it's valid for 60 days unless the board would then have to come back and take action to extend the proclamation further. And so, you know, that's really what we're looking at is a 60-day time frame. That, of course, could go further if it needed to. But yeah, that's really sort of, you know, the 60 days is, I don't anticipate needing to extend that, but, you know, we would look at it conditions at that time and determine if it was necessary to extend it at that point.
Just lastly here, Fresno County is not alone in making a proclamation like this. There are other regions in California as well that are taking a similar approach to this pest as well, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Kern County and Kings County have also made similar proclamations as well.
And in other Central Valley news, the Kings County Farm Bureau will be hosting a water forum on May 30th at the West Hills Lemoore campus. It will be an informational event that's open to the public to discuss GSA's SGMA and the next steps in the Tulare Lake Subbasin's probationary status. The trade show and light breakfast will start at 8 in the morning, and the panel discussion is set to begin at 10. This is the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. I'm your host, Brian German, and we'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. You're listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. I'm your host, Brian German, and we've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
What is happening on the prevention, education, and support front regarding the H5N1 strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza found in lactating dairy cattle in 9 states?
We are taking steps to make funding available under our Emergency Assistance for Livestock, Honeybees, and Farm-Raised Fish program to assist eligible producers with positive herds who have experienced a loss of milk production.
The teams at USDA, HHS, and throughout this administration are working aggressively to monitor the situation and communicate with the public about any findings.
I'm Rod Bain, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and Human and Health Services Secretary Xavier Becerra join us as we look at the latest news on federal response to the H5N1 outbreak in dairy cows in this edition of Agriculture USA. A recent update from federal partners involved in response efforts to an H5N1 high-path avian influenza outbreak found in dairy cattle. This is Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Increased testing, surveillance, and additional measures are underway to protect both human and animal health. At this stage, there's no concern about the safety of the commercial milk supply or beef supply. We continue to see affected cows recover with supportive treatment, with little associated mortality being reported. And it's also important to note that thus far, we have found no changes as significantly in the virus that would make it more transmissible to humans.
And as testing, study, and data collection continues regarding this particular H5N1 outbreak,
USDA remains committed to evolving its response and course of action. The more we know informs what we do, and we want to make sure that we're doing what is necessary to provide producers on the ground with the most available and most scientific information and direction.
Public concern about the safety of milk and dairy products was addressed by Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra.
The risk to the public from this outbreak remains low. All the scientific knowledge and data we've been able to collect to date supports the continued safety of the milk supply.
He explains USDA and the Food and Drug Administration
continue testing for H5N1 in retail milk and dairy supplies. That helps ensure the safety of the commercial pasteurized milk supply.
FDA is also providing an additional $8 million to fund ongoing and expanded response, including validation application of milk pasteurization criteria, surveillance at different points of the milk production system, increasing lab capacity, and training on biosecurity measures, and partnerships, both with states on milk safety and universities on research. In addition,
we've identified $93 million to be used by CDC to expand our monitoring of people exposed to infected animals, to scale up our testing and analysis capabilities, to determine whether candidate vaccines are effective, and to manufacture, store, and distribute additional influenza diagnostic kits.
Other measures enacted or being enacted include:
CDC continues to have ongoing discussions with multiple states about field investigations. We've reached out to representatives of the dairy workforce to make sure that we encourage participation of workers in trying to track the virus and the outbreak.
Meanwhile, USDA announced that in addition to continued interstate movement restrictions for lactating dairy cows and connected testing, there are now avenues of support available for producers impacted by the H5N1 outbreak. For instance,
to protect against the potential for spread between humans and animals, we're going to be providing financial support up to $2,000 per affected premises per month for producers who supply PPE to employees and or who provide outwear uniform laundry, or producers of affected herds who facilitate the participation of workers on the farm in a USDA CDC workplace and farm workers study.
In addition, support is available for biosecurity planning and implementation
to enable them to develop biosecurity plans based on existing secure milk supply plans that they have on the farm and recognizing the individual nature of their farming operation.
USDA will also provide $100 for producers to purchase and use an inline sampler for their milk system.
In addition, we're going to provide funding for heat treatment to dispose of milk in a biosecure fashion. This is going to provide producers a safe option for the disposal of milk. Heat treatment, performed in accordance with standards set by FDA, is currently the only available method considered to effectively inactivate the virus in milk. So if a producer establishes a system to heat treat waste milk before disposal, USDA will pay that producer up to $2,000 per affected premises per month.
The secretary adds there will also be reimbursement of veterinary costs incurred by producers associated with confirmed H5N1 cases in premises. And compensation will also be available through the Farm Service Agency's Emergency Assistance for Livestock, Honeybees, and Farm-Raised Fish Program associated with H5N1 positive tested dairy herds with reduced milk production. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. I'm your host, Brian German, and with today's agricultural law and tax report, here's Roger McGowan.
If you get a financial award from a court settlement or judgment, how is it taxed? The answer is that it depends on what the payment is for. Recoveries from an out-of-court settlement or a judgment may fall into any one of several categories. Damages received on account of personal physical injury or sickness are excluded from income. So amounts received on account of sickness or mental distress may be received tax-free if the sickness or distress is directly related to personal injury. But damages that aren't attributable to physical injury or physical sickness are includable in gross income. And damages representing punitive damages are always taxable as ordinary income. If the award includes lost profit from a business activity, it's ordinary income. But if the award compensates you for losses to your business assets, no income results except to the extent the damages exceed the income tax basis of the capital asset involved. The recovery is, in general, a taxable event, except to the extent the amount recovered represents a return of basis. That's different from recoveries representing a reimbursement for lost profit. Remember, those are taxable as ordinary income. So if you're injured in an accident and receive an award, make sure you consider the tax consequences involved. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Over the last couple of years, U.S. ag exports have faced some headwinds, but have remained above their historical averages. And
we're hoping we're going to have another strong performance with U.S. ag exports this year around the world.
Daniel Whitley runs the USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service, and he says exports for the first half of this fiscal year, October through March, are at just under $94.4 billion, 6% below the same time frame a year ago. Whitley says one of those headwinds that we were talking about that's hampering exports is the strong U.S. dollar, which makes our products more expensive for foreign buyers. But Whitley says that's just one factor. The other one is simple supply and demand.
What we've seen is the South American crop rebounding from three straight years of poor weather. They came and had a historical crop, like a once-in-a-generation crop. And that crop really competed with what we were doing here.
And still is. So U.S. ag export values, again, are running 6% below this time a year ago. And at the same time, our ag imports coming in from other countries are 2% higher. So the USDA trade update says we are dealing right now with an ag trade deficit. None of that sounds good. But as in the case of most statistical reports,
it's a mixed bag depending on which numbers you're looking at.
That's right. For example, USDA economist Bart Kinner says, yes, the value of U.S. ag exports, the value, is running 6% below this time a year ago, with larger declines for some products. However, if you look at the volumes of sales, different story.
Major bulk products are up 3% from last year in terms of volume. In terms of value, they're down 19% from last year. So we're seeing a big unit value decrease that is affecting the overall total export value, while we are continuing to increase volumes of those bulk exports.
Wheat shipments are running 5% higher than a year ago, cotton up 8%, corn up 36%. One major exception to the trend, soybeans, with export volume still 20% below a year ago. And there's that mixed bag thing again. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And on the subject of trade, there are some new regulations for plastics in the European Union and Canada that are going to impact American exporters. Beginning in September 2025, the Federal Plastics Registry in Canada will come into effect. It mandates reporting on plastic quantity, types, and disposal methods. U.S. exporters will also be expected to comply with the reporting requirements, which will impact plastic products used in agriculture and horticulture, such as ag containers, totes and drums, and film and sheeting. The EU's Packaging and Packaging Waste Regulation introduces waste reduction targets and requires that all packaging placed on the EU market is recyclable and carries recycling labeling. The packaging reduction targets are a 5% reduction by 2030, 10% by 2035, and 15% by 2040 compared to 2018 levels. All packaging will also have to be recyclable by 2030. And in other news, UC Agriculture and Natural Resources will be hosting two webinars going over wildfire preparedness strategies for farms. The UCANR Fire Network team will be highlighting how to harden structures and manage livestock during a wildfire in a two-part webinar series. The first webinar will take place on May 21st. UC Cooperative Extension Fire and Forest Advisors will be discussing best practices for incorporating principles of structure hardening and defensible space into agricultural structures and operations. Part 2 of the series will take place the following week on May 28th. Cooperative Extension Livestock and Natural Resources Advisors, along with other partners, will provide a set of presentations about managing livestock health during wildfire events and what to do if trapped by an approaching wildfire. More information about the webinars is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. You're listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. And now we've got this week's almond update from the Almond Board of California. And today we're talking once again with Senior Specialist of Industry Communications for the Almond Board, Taylor Hillman. Taylor, thanks for joining us again this morning.
Thank you, Brian. Happy to be here.
And we've talked a little bit about the ongoing elections. And for people that might not have caught that and want to get up to speed, where are we in the election process?
Yeah, Brian. So as we talked last time, the 2024-2025 Almond Board of California elections are underway. The ballots have been mailed out. They were mailed out April 29th. That's just a couple of weeks ago. However, if growers have not received a ballot and want to receive a ballot, they need to contact their handler, and their handler can let them know on how to get one of those ballots, or they can contact the Almond Board of California directly. We do have a page, almonds.com/elections, where growers can go to and find out how to get a ballot. We rely on the handler's mailing lists, and sometimes those can be incorrect. So If you have not received a ballot yet, again, they went out 2 weeks ago. That's plenty of time for it to have hit your mailboxes. If you have not received a ballot and would like a ballot, you can contact your handler or go to almonds.com/elections to figure out how to receive a ballot.
And this year, there are quite a few incumbents we've talked about at length a couple weeks ago now, but there are some runoffs. So what are people voting for here this year?
Yeah, there are four positions that are voted on for this election. There are four open seats. It's the independent grower number one, which is the one-year swing. Those are incumbents. It's Paul Ewing as the member and then Katie Stack as the alternate. There's independent grower number three. That's a three-year term that is up this year. That is Joe Gardner as the member. He's the incumbent. And right now there is not anybody running for that alternate position. There's the independent handler number two, again, a three-year term. The incumbent is Bob Silvera, and he is running unopposed. But then there is a runoff for the alternate position for that independent handler number two, and that is between Dexter Long and Justin Moorhead, Dexter Long being the incumbent. And then finally, independent handler number three, which is a one-year swing. Again, the incumbents are Darren Rigg as the member and Chad DeRose as the alternate, though they are both the incumbents and are running unopposed. So just one runoff for an alternate seat, but it's important to stay involved, let your voice be heard, and be able to participate in these elections for the upcoming 24-25 Almond Board seats.
And now, with those ballots being mailed out, everyone should have received it by now. If not, should contact the Almond Board. And when are those going to need to be sent back in, and what's going to be the next step in this process?
Yeah, that's a good point. So May 23rd, it's coming up very quickly. It's the last day for ABC to receive signed ballots. Election voting ends that day. So if you do need to get a ballot, you need to do it fairly quickly because you will need to fill it out and mail it back postmark May 23rd. So everyone needs to get their ballots in. If you've been waiting, you need to fill that out. You're running out of time to cast your ballot, cast your vote. June 1st, the election results will be announced. And then August 1st is when new terms of office begins. So again, us talking today, there's 1 week left to get your vote in. So if you do need to, again, to get the ballot and get it back into us, you need to do so quickly with 1 week left.
So ballots are out. All industry members are encouraged to participate in this election process to really kind of take part in shaping that. And for those that are interested in maybe participating more in some of the activities that the Almond Board is engaged in, what kind of opportunities are there?
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Brian. So after the election, our committee formation will take place in August as well. Aside from the board of directors, there's more than 150 active Almond industry members that volunteer on board appointed committees, subcommittees, sometimes working groups. Getting involved in the California almond industry, it's a great way to ensure that almonds remain an essential crop in California and are demanded by consumers around the world. The board's always looking for new volunteers and accepts applications throughout the year. And again, this formation process will happen in August. There's lots of different committees to be on, all aspects of the almond industry, whether it's almond quality and food safety or the organic advisory panel. You could even sit in on the finance and audit committee. My committee, which is the Global Communications Committee, or Market Development, of course. There's lots of different places for people to participate and to volunteer and help guide the efforts of ABC. So I highly encourage people to, the first step to getting involved is to really join one of these committees. If you don't want to commit yet, you can always attend one of these committee meetings by going to our website under the events page. participating, watching one of these committee meetings and seeing what they're all about. But again, the committee formation will take place in August as well. And it's a great place to start if you're thinking about getting involved.
Very good. So lots of opportunities there to learn more or take a more active role in the industry there. And if for anyone that wants to learn more about the election process that's currently underway or want to learn more about what opportunities might be there with some of those committees, where can people find some of that information?
Yeah, absolutely. Almonds.com/about us. So across the top, there's a menu. It says about us. In that drop down, you'll see a page for committees and a page for elections. Both of them has all the information you need and all the forms you want to look at. So if you're on the committee page, you'll be able to read what each committee is about and then have a link to the statement of interest form, which you can fill out, and then someone will contact you about participating. And then the election page has all those dates that we recapped, all the positions and names that are available, and frequently asked questions about how to be involved, how to get involved, what the board does, and all that information. So again, almonds.com/about us. If you just go to almonds.com, about us is across the top in the main menu.
Very cool. Once again, Senior Specialist of Industry Communications for the Almond Board, Taylor Hillman, joined us this morning. Taylor, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Brian.
You're listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. We're joined now by Cooperative Extension Table Grape Advisor for Tulare and Kings Counties, Joy Hollingsworth, and we're talking about a needs assessment that was conducted recently, highlighting some of the thoughts and concerns among the industry. And so, Joy, let's start with how that assessment was conducted and what kind of responses you got.
So just a little bit of background. The reason that I did the needs assessment is I'm fairly new to my position. I started about 2 years ago, and I'm still learning about grapes, and so I really wanted to get a good feel for what the needs of my clientele are before I dive into a research and extension program. So I did a lot of just chatting with people and looking at other people's surveys and things like that before I sent out my needs assessment. But what I ended up doing, so last year, last March in 2023, I sent out a letter and a short survey to a list that came from a couple different sources. One was the County Ag Commissioner's list of grape growers for Tulare and Kings Counties. And then I combined that with a list of contacts from my predecessors. There has been a table grape advisor in Tulare County for a long time, so luckily I have a lot of resources that I can draw on from that, and as well as an email list that was existing from my predecessors as well. So ultimately, I sent out the survey to 1,166 surveys between email and mail. And I got a response of about 123, which is a 10 to 11% response rate. So I was pretty happy with that.
And so from those responses that were received, what were some of the demographics of those responses in terms of areas or varieties grown or types of industry members that participated in the survey?
Yeah, so my position it's focused on table grapes, but, you know, of course, there's a lot of overlap between growers who grow wine and raisin grapes as well. And again, I'm based in Tulare in Kings Counties, but again, a lot of people grow in multiple counties. And it's, even though my focus is table, I think it's really important for me to have a good understanding of what's going on in the other grape industries to see if I can be of service to the others. So I asked if there are growers or PCAs or CCAs, and people had the option to check more than one box, because again, there's lots of, you know, people wear many hats. So the majority of the responses were from growers, about 78%, but a fair number of PCAs as well, about 20%, and then nearly 10% each of certified crop advisors, industry representatives, and some others that didn't fit into any of those categories. And as far as counties, again, the majority of the responses came from either Tulare or Fresno County, 50 to 60%, but a good representation of close to 25% each from Kings and Kern counties. And then we had some others. Some people also work in Madera. There was some on the coast, maybe San Luis Obispo. And then as far as types of grapes grown, a lot of the response is pretty fairly even, a little bit more emphasis on table and raisin grapes, but also a fair amount of wine grapes. So between 45, 50, 55% of each of those. And then about a little over 90% of the respondents grew conventionally, but also about 27% grew organically. So I imagine there's definitely some overlap there, people growing both conventional and organic.
Now that seemed a bit interesting with the overlap in the types of grapes grown. It seems like they're about roughly even. So that would mean that basically most of these growers are dabbling in various different types of grapes that they've got in their operation, right?
Yeah, definitely. And again, they're also overlapping in counties. And so it's important to get an overall picture. That's why I could have tried to limit it to just table grapes and just Tulare and Kings counties, but I think I would have been missing some information that way. So
trying to get a broader look at the industry, if possible, there with multiple geographies. And now with some of the responses, there were some significant concerns or issues that industry members are facing. And it looks like powdery mildew and mealybug seem the greatest concerns that were identified, right?
Yeah. Oh, and you know, I'm sorry. I did want to back up and say that I don't want to overemphasize the importance of the study that I did. It was not a peer-reviewed research. This is kind of informational to me, and I think it's interesting. So I want to share and also want, you know, to let people know what I'm doing. But I don't want to make any broad sweeping generalization saying just because this is what I saw in my survey, I'm not trying to indicate that this is necessarily what's going on everywhere. So I can only speak to obviously the growers who responded to the survey. But from the responses that I saw, yes, powdery mildew and mealybugs were definitely top of the list. And that was something that I had heard kind of anecdotally, but it was nice to get some confirmation from that from the survey response.
And as you noted, this was an informal survey just to kind of get a baseline of information as best as possible from industry members. But moving forward, how are these results of this survey maybe going to shape some of the research and outreach efforts, or how will this information be put into action?
Yeah, so that's definitely going to impact the program, the research and extension program that I put together. It helps give me an idea of what the importance needs are for the people that I'm serving in my areas, in my counties. So I'm definitely taking a close look at this. And there's so many different directions you can go. There's no way to tackle everything. But it's nice to have a little bit of some guideposts to say what some areas of interest are for growers. So one example is that I have a background in weed science a little bit, and it's an interest of mine. So it was good for me to see that there was some interest in weeds from the growers. I know that, you know, it's not always the biggest issue. Grapes are pretty competitive, but there does seem to be a strong interest in different weed management techniques. And one thing that I thought was particularly interesting on the weeds was that like 27% of the respondents managed organic grapes, but 37% of respondents were interested in organic weed control. So I think that's indicating that even people who are not necessarily managing organically are kind of interested to see what's going on with organic weed management. So I think that's a potential area to pursue.
Now that's interesting. Organic production methods getting some additional interest there from conventional growers. Is there any indication or maybe hypothesis as to what might be the driver behind that?
Yeah. And again, I mean, the surveys are a little bit limited in that you can only, you know, there's not really any whys unless someone wrote in on an open-ended question. I don't have the answer to that. But I do think that it does seem to be a sense of a growing interest in, you know, it seems like this is always the case, but in sustainability. And another thing that I saw that kind of indicated that was a strong interest in soil health. And that's something that's really big, been up and coming, I think, fairly recently. So it might just be kind of a general theme that we're seeing.
Gotcha. And now the results of the assessment are available online in the San Joaquin Valley Viticulture Newsletter. So anybody interested can take a deeper dive on what some of these results showed there. And now just lastly, was there anything that stood out or that you wanted to cover here?
Mostly, I just wanted to let people know that I'm out there, that I'm doing this work, and I'm really interested in feedback. I want to know another reason that I wrote up this article was, again, to kind of introduce myself, to let people know what I'm doing and to get feedback from them on what their interests are. If they read this article and that if they thought I got something wrong, or if there was a need that I didn't think to list on my survey that they think is important for me to know about, I would love to hear from them just to make sure that I'm working on things that are important to the community.
This is the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. I'm your host, Brian German, and we'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. I'm your host, Brian German, and we're joined by Whitney Brim-DeForest once again today, rice and wild rice farm advisor in Sutter, Yuba, Placer, and Sacramento counties. And now, Whitney, there are a couple of different rice events that are going to be taking place this summer, right?
We do. So we have, let me make sure I have the dates right here. So we have our drill seeded field day, which I believe is June 18th. And that we'll have more info coming on the agenda and everything, but that'll be at the Rice Experiment Station. We have a rice quality workshop, which is the first time we've done this in a long time, I believe, maybe 10 years. And that'll be July 18th. And again, agenda is forthcoming, although I believe registration might be open for that one already. I have to check. The drill seated one, no registration necessary, just show up. And then the rice quality workshop is, you know, an indoor sit down, and we go through post-harvest related to rice. The drill seeded one is obviously in the field. And then rice field day, same as always, the last Wednesday in August. And then we do have a rice pest management workshop in September, and that'll be the first time we've had that in, I think, about 3 years. And that'll be at the Rice Experiment Station. And again, registration and all that information will be forthcoming.
Well, very cool. And for anyone that wants to stay tuned for those or register or just learn more about it, where can they get that information?
So our website for all of UC Rice is agronomy-rice.ucdavis.edu. We do have a new website. So everything should be posted there, or they can always give us a call and we can add them to our mailing list, and they'll get a newsletter, either email or paper version if they'd like.
And in other news, the California Department of Water Resources released the latest semi-annual groundwater conditions report showing a marked improvement after a strong water year in 2023. The data show that California achieved 4.1 million acre-feet of managed groundwater recharge, which is roughly the equivalent of the water storage capacity of Shasta Lake. The report also details an increase in groundwater storage of 8.7 million acre-feet. It marks the first time since 2019 there's been a reported increase in groundwater storage. A critical component of the increase was the priority placed on groundwater recharge efforts. More than 1.2 million acre-feet of groundwater recharge was permitted by state agencies during the 2023 water year. And now here's Will Jordan with a report about conservation funding.
A pair of Democrat senators, Michael Bennett of Colorado and Chris Coons of Delaware, along with 24 of their Senate colleagues, called on the Senate Appropriations Committee to fully fund agricultural conservation programs in the fiscal year 2025 funding bill. Land-based mitigation measures in agriculture, forestry, and other land use sectors represent some of the most important options currently available for large-scale emissions reductions and the removal and storage of carbon dioxide at scale. The senator said in a letter to appropriations leaders, "We need strong investments in USDA's natural resources conservation staff and resources to support farmers, ranchers, and foresters to help mitigate and adapt to climate change." The senators highlighted the success of ag conservation programs like EQIP, the Conservation Stewardship Program, and many others. For more information, visit agnetwest.com. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.